today is First Transit versus Chernikov, case number 70164. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Please, Your Honor, I'd like to try to save 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Pickering. May it please the court, Dan Paulsenberg for the appellant. This case presents three reasons why there was not a fair trial in this case, especially since it involved an injury that we could argue plaintiff's decedent caused to himself. In our briefs, we set out the three arguments. Number one is that plaintiff's decedent was not put on the comparative negligence special verdict form, although 41.141 requires it. Secondly, even in comparing the negligence of the parties and the decedent, the district court instructed on a common carrier higher standard of care. And third, there were a number of things that happened during the closing arguments such as the jury should send a message that all lives matter, that distorted the jury's deliberation and resulted in excessive damages. Since the court's opinions, and we're on rehearing today, since the court's opinions dealt mostly with the common carrier standard of care, let me start there this time. It is true throughout the law, throughout even the evolution of Nevada law, that the common carrier standard of a higher degree, the highest possible degree of care, really only applies when you're talking about transportation-related risks. It would be alighting, disembarking, the operation of the vehicle. During oral argument, we brought up maintenance, and Chief Justice Pickering, even during oral argument, said that attacks could be covered under that standard. And that seems to be where the real dispute is between the majority and the dissent in this case. The majority cites cases that say that batteries would not arise under the standard of care, and because they're not transportation related. The dissent says that they should be. And in the briefing on the petition for rehearing, both sides agree that batteries and attacks can be transportation related. There are a couple of reasons for this. One is because of the confines of a vehicle. Another is because if you take the common law all the way back to the beginning, one of the main reasons we had a higher standard of care, both for innkeepers and for common carriers, is because of the fear of highwaymen, attacks upon the passengers. So that was part of the duty. There you are.
You're fading out.
Is that any better?
Yeah. It is. Thank you.
Great. David, can you take a look at that and see what's happening? Okay. David's not on. So, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes used to talk about the reason behind the rule in his treatise, the Common Law. He said, rules develop for a reason. And when the reason goes away, the rule persists. Now, this court has been very good at not falling into that trap. In Bullion versus Barrick, it pointed out that the statute we have in NRS Chapter 1 that says that the Common Law of England is the law of Nevada will not keep us from advancing the law to modern times. A lot of the reason for the common carrier standard doesn't exist anymore. Day after tomorrow, I have an argument in the Ninth Circuit about the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. We have ways to make common carriers safer. But I'm not advocating getting rid of the rule. I'm advocating keeping it as narrowly tailored as it was originally meant to be. I think the majority...
Mr. Paulsenberg, in your answering...
Justice Silver.
Thank you. Regarding the waiver argument, You cite to Otterbeck versus Lamb, which is a 1969 case. Echeverry is a 1991 case. Now, the district court sitting here never got a proposed instruction on what you're now arguing regarding common law and transportation-related risks. Never proposed any instruction. And obviously didn't object. You actually, it almost reads like there were competing instructions by the plaintiffs and defendants over the pattern instruction that was eventually given. Why doesn't waiver apply here?
Waiver doesn't apply because this was a threshold issue where we were talking about what theories this case should go to the jury on. In fact, Otterbeck has that great line that says that an objection at trial doesn't have to have the niceties and nuances of a brief writer. What we did here is say we don't think the higher standard applies. We thought the case should go to the jury on ordinary negligence.
But you didn't mark, a jury instruction at all. You didn't propose any instruction on ordinary negligence.
No, we objected to that instruction. We objected to the instruction on the higher duty of care because it was wrong. And that's the only thing we had to do to object to an improper jury instruction. Let me make a comment at this point because I think there's some confusion about the standard of review. This court has two standards of review for jury instructions. One is abuse of discretion, and the dissent talks about that. And it's true, a district court does have some discretion on how to style jury instructions, but the court does not have the discretion to instruct on improper or inapplicable law. And that's an error of law, and that's why we think there was that legal error.
Mr. Goldberger?
If the judge had... Your Honor.
Sorry, I mean, this is an imperfect medium, so I apologize. Two things. Why wasn't under Forrester these instructions fine about foreseeable and preventable issues, especially when your safety manager and your driver testify that there are rules about eating and drinking to prevent choking specifically? So that's the first question. The second is, there's no objections in this closing argument that now is so damning that we should reverse this jury's verdict. So how does the court deal with that?
Let me take that as three questions. First, under Forrester, remember there the railroad allowed a beating of the passenger and then kicked him off the train in the middle of nowhere, which resulted in pneumonia and death. So those are clearly transportation-related issues. Help me on your second question.
I only had two questions. You turned them into three, so I don't know what the third one is.
I did. Help me on your first question, then.
How is this not foreseeable and preventable? I mean, certainly you read the dissent, you read the majority.
Right.
Your own safety manager, they all address that the danger here is choking.
Well, sure. And foreseeability is essential to a negligence case under the ordinary standard of care. And so foreseeability would be an issue. I'm not saying there isn't a negligence case here. I'm just saying there isn't a higher standard of care here. And when they keep talking about assumed duties go to negligence, not to the highest possible degree of care under a common carrier. So they can bring up those issues in a negligence case. They constantly talk about how there was a duty to scan every 5 seconds, but nowhere in any of their briefing do they even try to argue that that duty of scan was to prevent somebody from eating. So how this measures out, again, we've got to balance our duty under ordinary care, not this Derek Jeter duty, against Mr. Chernikov's own negligence in consuming the food, as his expert says, wolfing it down, causing himself to choke.
Did we object? I apologize. So tell me, how is getting beaten up by another passenger, a transportation-related risk, but choking on food on a bus is not a transportation-related risk. Can you explain the distinction, please?
Yes, because other passengers being there in confinement, we put them in a situation where it's possible that there's injury. That's why I think possible for battery, because that goes all the way back to thieves on the railroads. Eating is, you know, it's, we quote the line in our open brief and in our response to the petition for rehearing, that we are not required, that we're not liable, our duty does not extend to the same dangers a passenger meets in the same way and to the same extent he meets in his daily life and from which he must protect himself. So, yes, if he doesn't chew his food properly, if he wolfs it down, if it causes himself to choke, that is the same kind of hazard he would face outside that he would face inside. Let me get to Justice Kagan, if I may, get back to Justice Stiglitz's second question. Did we object during closing argument? No, we didn't. Which is why I'm arguing that in two ways. Just as I argued the last time we did this, under 59AC, remember we're under the old rules of civil procedure, if the argument was such to create passion and prejudice resulting in excessive damages, that's the grounds for a new trial. That's not the same standard as misconduct. And even if we were to look at Leoci, I think the only way, I don't need this for the comparative negligence issue because I was not allowed to get a proper standard for me. I was not allowed to consider Mr. Chernikov's own negligence. But if you look at the damages, $15 million, $7.5 million for conscious pain and suffering for less than a minute, this identical amount, $7.5 for grief and sorrow for the death of a 51-year-old man. I mean, I'm not trying to be callous, but the fact of the matter is these are excessive damages, and under Leoci, the only way you could explain them is this oral argument that talked about the value of a person, that talked about all lives matter, that say send a signal that people in Las Vegas are worth more. Under all those circumstances, this was not a fair result. And we need a new trial. Not but to save the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Pickering and Justices. As the court is aware, there's a nationwide issue right now with a 8-minute video of George Floyd losing his life. The jurors saw Harvey Chernikov die in this case. This wasn't something that the attorneys had to describe orally. They had the video. Their own expert testified that this was a horrible way to die. In fact, he argued that choking is so horrible that that's why he didn't believe that this was choking, is because he said people that choke to death flail around and you don't see that on the video, and that's why this was not a choking death, but rather heart attack. Addressing that very briefly, I want to now turn my attention to why this jury instruction issue was waived. Specifically, Otterbeck says, quote, because the district court understood the basis for the objection, there it was not waived. That's what First Transit seeks refuge from, that citation from Otterbeck. However, when one looks at the transcript at 1575 through 1578, there were two very distinct issues that needed to be addressed. Number one, what is the definition of common carrier and whether First Transit even should be defined as a common carrier? Specifically, First Transit said, look, we don't have a problem with the definition. We just don't think that we're even a common carrier. The district court said, well, tell me why you don't think so. And in nine lines, they tried to articulate why they shouldn't be considered a common carrier. Very importantly, on page 1578, line 13 through 16, the judge made a ruling on that issue, this number one issue, as to whether the definition should even apply. The court said, quote, I think that there has been evidence to support the definition of a common carrier. With that being said, now she goes to number two. What do you propose as its instruction for the duty of care? So those are two separate, very distinct issues that the judge was ruling on. Number one, are you even a common carrier? And number two, if yes, to the threshold question, then what is the duty? And when First Transit was asked about the duty, they could have said several things. They could have said, well, Your Honor, we think that a common carrier in this circumstance is only has to provide ordinary care. They could have said, well, Your Honor, our instruction that we want is that because First Transit was only transporting Harvey from point A to point B, it's just common carrier, ordinary care. They could have said, Your Honor, we agree that this is a common carrier, but because the action of eating was a, quote, non-transportation related risk, because of that, we think that the duty should be only ordinary care. The fact remains they didn't do any of that. What they did is they proposed the very instruction that was given, the very instruction that they now complain of. And it is interesting because if the court continues to read through the transcript, the court will see that later at 1584, a second decision was made or a second ruling was made by the judge. The judge made two distinct rulings. One, does common carrier even apply? And then once that decision was made, she invited First Transit to propose number two, what is the duty? And it was First Transit's instruction that was given to the jurors. Furthermore, even if the court finds that the words that were stated and the decisions weren't distinct, they are still in violation of NRCP 51C and Cook v. Sunrise Hospital, which require a party to cite relevant case authority in support of an objection to satisfy 51C. They did not cite to any relevant authority. Next, I want to focus on Jury Instruction 34, the heightened duty for folks with disabilities. And importantly, this is a newly created doctrine by First Transit. When the court does research on transportation-related risk, only two cases nationwide come up on Westlaw. Number one, a 2013 unpublished California case, which has nothing to do with carrier, common carrier law, and number two, Chernikov. Similarly, when the court looks at non-transportation risk, only one case is retrieved nationwide, which is the now vacated Chernikov decision. And so every common carrier case cited by the majority actually supports affirmance and supports the decision to affirm this jury verdict. Justice Kadish, I want to talk about your question briefly for a moment. You asked about what distinguishes a fight versus a situation like Harvey. Well, what distinguishes that is in the setting, a regular setting, generally speaking, the person on a bus is at the risk of, or not at the risk, but kind of is at the mercy of the bus driver. The specific facts of this case are that Harvey Chernikov lacked the cognitive ability and awareness to even remove his own seatbelt. So when you're dealing with an individual with a disability, he does not have the wherewithal to remove his seatbelt and walk up to the driver and specifically ask for help. Instead, what does he do? He sits there, and over a period of 7 or 8 minutes, he slowly dies. And that is the reason that in this instance, an individual with a disability, this is why the instructions that were given support this, is that number one, there is a special relationship between First Transit and Harvey Chernikov. Harvey was not a regular passenger that the bus stopped at the corner and picked him up and somehow voluntarily assumed these additional duties. What was overlooked was that Harvey had to go through the screening process. He had to go and meet with the RTC individuals. They understood the basis of his disability, and then that information was provided to First Transit. And any time one of these passengers was picked up, the driver had a manifest. And on that manifest, it indicated what the disability was. So the driver was aware, okay, my next passenger has this particular disability. And in this instance, Justice Stiglitz, touching upon what you said, here is some of the testimony. This is on page 591, volume 3, appellate appendix. Quote, there was a policy that operators are required to check their mirrors while driving, and that includes the interior of the bus. Answer, that's true. And you agree that one of the rules that must be followed is to not eat or drink on the bus. True? Answer, yes, that's true. Quote, you told us it's important to enforce the rule because you don't want passengers to eat on the bus because they could choke and hurt themselves. True? Answer, that's one of the reasons, yes. Quote, you testified it's actually a foreseeable harm of eating on the bus is that somebody could choke, and if they choke, they could choke to death. True? Answer, that's true. That's Appellate Appendix 6, page 1345. That's the safety director. Then the bus driver testified that the mirrors were there to see if the passengers were safe. He testified that the rule against eating was a safety rule, and that the reason it was explained to him by the company was as to prevent people, because of the risk of choking, prevent people like Harvey from choking. Further, the company explained to him that if somebody choked, that could lead to death. Finally, on page 815, he admitted that it was foreseeable risk that allowing someone to eat on the bus could lead to choking and death. And finally, on page 816, and this is something that I believe that the prior majority overlooked, was that both the driver and Jennifer McKibbins testified that when you're dealing with folks with disabilities, and this is why jury instruction 34 was appropriate, when you're dealing with individuals with a disability, they do things that are unpredictable. Specifically, Jay Ferrales testified that he enforced not only the no eating policy, but he also enforced, quote, other kind of things that would come up, like a lot of things that our passengers are doing that are inappropriate or they're not supposed to be doing, end quote. Further, Jennifer McKibbins testified, and this was regarding the scanning the bus. This is the five-second rule. We disagree with First Transit. The five-second rule was one of the reasons was to prevent people from eating. She testified, quote, again, we're talking about passengers with disabilities. There are passengers that fight on the bus. There's a brother and sister that fight on the bus. You can't sit them together because if you sit them together, the sister is going to beat the you-know-what out of the brother. You have to keep them apart. So there are things that could happen on a bus, end quote. So she talks about how with this specific rider population, there are additional risks that are foreseeable to the company. One of those additional risks happened to be eating on the bus. That's why they had the policy in the first place, was because they had dealt with this before.
Mr. Clower, may I ask you a question, interrupt you for just a second? You got about 4 minutes left. Can you address Mr. Polzensberg's position on the comparative negligence in the jury verdict form?
Absolutely. Again, pursuant to Banks v. Sunrise, they did not propose an alternative instruction. They did not even request an alternative, a special verdict form. They didn't ask for a verdict form to have Harvey listed. That's not preserved. Again, that's not preserved. And Justice Gibbons, in a case called BMW v. Roth, indicated that it's not fair for a defendant to sandbag. And that case was a criminal case. He said it's not fair to sandbag the state by saving an objection for an appeal in order to secure reversal and an undeserved second bite from the district court's apple. In this case...
Excuse me for a moment, sir. What do you make of the statement in Volume 7 at 1608 to 09 of the record where Ms. Sanders says, I think that Harvey has to be included on the verdict form. It's a wrongful death case. You don't have a state, and she goes on. There isn't a reason... So to the extent that there is comparative negligence for Harvey for violating the rule about eating on the bus, his negligence is certainly relevant and is something that would be imputed to the plaintiffs.
Again, Your Honor, Chief Justice Pickering, this was something that was addressed last argument. The court ruled that there was a procedural, that it was procedurally ineffective to make that argument. And the reason that it was procedurally ineffective is because there was a pause in the proceedings. It had ended. The argument had ended. And it was only after the transcript returned, resumed, that Ms. Sanders attempted to continue to re-argue. What should have been procedurally proper at that moment is to do a motion for reconsideration rather than trying to go back into something that had already been decided, that the court had moved on. But Justice, Chief Justice Pickering, I think the bigger issue that is much more important in this is that there is not a bona fide issue as to Harvey's negligence. One of the things that is required by First Transit is to prove not only that Harvey was negligent, but that the death was caused by that negligence. Never one time did First Transit ever concede that he choked. Their entire position, they put every single egg in the basket that he had a heart attack. Their doctor never once testified that he, in fact, choked and that the death was a result of choking. It was always, he had a heart attack, ladies and gentlemen. It's unfortunate. Even good men die from heart attacks. That's what they said to the jurors. But one other thing that I think...
Mr. Clower, let me get that straight. So at no time did First Transit argue that Mr. Chernikov choked, you know, through the eating. It was a heart attack. So your position, there wasn't evidence to support giving an instruction about comparative negligence?
Correct, Justice Gibbons. Never one time did First Transit concede that Harvey choked. Instead, the entire argument, if you look at their... If you look at their opening slides, and I think they had slides in the closing, but certainly in the opening, and I have scoured the transcript, and I can assure the court there is never one time where First Transit said that, look, Harvey choked. It was always that he had a heart attack. But one thing, in, I guess, that I wanted to talk about as to why a comparative instruction wouldn't be appropriate anyway is because of the statutory issue. This was a claim that was brought pursuant to NRS 41. And this was something that we didn't have a chance to discuss last time where the derivative issue. This was not a derivative claim based on common law. This was a claim that was based on statute, and the statute 41-141, specifically, if you replace defendants with, or if you replace parties with defendants, it turns the statute upside down. The analytical framework needs to stay within the statute because that is what the cause of action was based on, was the statute. And when the court does that, it should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Paulsenberg.
Looks like we lost him.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address two issues that frustrate me so much. One is the waiver argument. Rex Jemison has always said that waiver is the first refuge of respondents. There really is no obligation when we're simply asking for something simple to propose another jury instruction or another verdict form. Going to Justice Silver's question, we objected to the higher standard of care. The ordinary standard of care was already in the jury instructions under Instruction 26, so we didn't have to propose anything else. Now, they come in here and say that...
Excuse me, Mr. Paulsenberg. What do you say to his argument, though, that when you look at what was argued to the judge during the settling instructions...
That's my very next point.
Let me just finish that sentence. It does appear that the only thing Ms. Hoyt, if that's her name, said was something to the effect of, we don't believe that First Transit's even a common carrier. And it appeared that she was just arguing that
First Transit wasn't a common carrier. That's what it appears in, no, in the settling of instructions.
Well, actually, Judge Miley said, so what's your objection? Are you saying that First Transit is a, you don't think First Transit's a common carrier? And Ms. Heisen said that the issue is, I think we even conceded that we were a common carrier. I can't see how anybody would object to that, but we object to the inapplicability of the jury instruction. We talked about whether it had to do with boarding, alighting, with our driving skills, with the transportation of him. It was a medical event, and that's not what is contemplated in the common carrier instruction. It is not actually the work of a common carrier that's at issue here, and that's why the instruction wouldn't be relevant. Yes, we're a common carrier, but this doesn't have to do with the work of a common carrier. They also say we proposed the very instruction. You know, the majority opinion handled so well an issue I've seen in four dozen trials where somebody has proposed a badly worded jury instruction. I object on the substance of the law. I lose on that, but I'm still able to say let's at least correct the wording of it all. How do we look at comparative negligence of the parties? What they're raising is all assumed duties. Your Honor, if I may have half a minute, as Mr. Cloward had.
You may have 30 seconds. Mr. Cloward had an extra 30.
Thank you, Your Honor. What they're basically talking about is an assumed duty. They're not talking about the higher duty. And an assumed duty, scanning the bus and all those other issues, would be based on ordinary negligence principles. And you'd have to compare that to what Mr. Chernikov himself did. Look, 41.141, and I spent most of my time in the last argument on that, because when we adopted a wrongful death statute in 1979, we changed 41.141 to say you have to consider the comparative fault of the decedent. The 87 amendment was a compromise that doesn't apply in these circumstances. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Chief Justice, if I may ask Mr. Polzenberg one more question on that point he just made.
Yes, is that Justice Perger?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Mr. Polzenberg, you heard Mr. Cloward's argument that you had discussed nothing about the fact that he had a heart attack. Can you explain that to me?
Well, our closing argument has nothing to do with whether we are entitled to a verdict form. The evidence, we had an affirmative defense of comparative negligence of the plaintiff. There was evidence of that. We should have been allowed to go to the jury on it, and it should have been on the verdict form.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions of any justice in Carson City? Justice Gibbons?
I do. If I could ask Mr. Polzenberg one more question to follow up to the last one. Mr. Polzenberg, Mr. Cloward said that Ms. Sanders was tardy in making the argument about the verdict form. I understood him to say the court had ruled, and we'll check the transcript on this, but the court had ruled on that, and it was like an afterthought to come in and make the argument there about the comparative negligence and about the verdict form. What's your position on that?
I'm not sure the district court had ruled. The district court had expressed an inclination, and then Mr. Alverson had acquiesced in that, and then immediately afterwards, Ms. Sanders, who was the person who was arguing the jury instructions with Ms. Heisen, said, no, that's not right. So I don't think procedurally that's a waiver of an issue. The reason we, under Landmark Moore, the reason we're obligated to raise issues is to give the district judge the chance to do the right thing. It's not like we have gone to the jury and then afterwards said, Your Honor, we'd like to take the whole case back and come up with a different verdict form.
Okay, thank you.
Chief,
thank you, Your Honor.
Chief, may I ask a question?
Of Mr. Polzenberg or Mr. Cloward?
Of Mr. Polzenberg.
Okay. I'm concerned about fairness to Mr. Cloward here, but please go ahead. I'll give you a minute, Mr. Cloward.
Thank you.
Mr. Polzenberg, just to indulge Justice Perger's question, to actually answer it. The First Transit took the position that Harvey Chernikoff died of a heart attack and not of choking. Isn't that correct?
Right.
First Transit took the position that the parents were at fault. Isn't that correct?
No, we took the position that that all three of them should be on the verdict form, the parents and Harvey. And the judge said, I think it should be one or the other. I think it should be the parents. Under the restatement, it should be all three of them. But under our statute, it should certainly be the plaintiff's decedent.
And finally, thank you, and finally, First Transit, there was evidence certainly that there was a business decision made that at least in the Clark County area or the Las Vegas area, the drivers would not be trained on first aid that was represented in the manual. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that was part of the contract with Clark County.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I realize this is unusual, but Mr. Pulsenberg has had additional time, and I don't know if Mr. Cloward has any sir rebuttal to what Mr. Pulsenberg said, but I'd like to give him a minute to do that.
Chief Justice Pickering, I appreciate that. Thank you very much, and I would like to address that. The contract that Mr. Pulsenberg refers to never indicated that first aid would not be provided. In fact, when First Transit went through the bid process, it provided a packet of documents and materials that should be provided. Somebody at the Las Vegas local level decided, made that decision independent. It was never contractually that they could not provide First Transit or first aid training. So that was a decision that was made by somebody that was an inappropriate decision. I wanted to touch very, very briefly on... And I just had a loss of thought on that. It was something that one of the questions that was asked. On the heart attack, that is an affirmative duty. They are required to prove causation as in addition to breach in the comparative negligence analysis. They have to show, and that's part of their affirmative obligation. First Transit just admitted that they presented no evidence that he died of a heart attack or died of choking. So that the whole comparative argument falls right there. Any further discussion about whether Harvey should have been on the verdict form or should not have been on the verdict form should end right there because they have to show causation as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This matter will stand submitted and we will be in recess until 11 o'clock. The court's going to reassemble for that argument. I want to thank both counsel for their presentations today, and we will be in recess for another 20 minutes. Thank you.